If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
I'm Jane Pauley, and this is Sunday Morning. The holiday season is well underway, but this morning it's the everyday that we're going to celebrate. Everyday heroes, to be exact. Everyday ordinary people do extraordinary things for others, and they deserve every honor and recognition they receive, as Scott Simon of NPR will report in our cover story.
What would make a perfectly rational person run toward danger instead of away from it?
I don't know why I ran towards it. I just reached down there and grabbed Chase, all 90 pounds of him, and pulled him out.
And it is my distinct honor and privilege to present to you the Carnegie Medal for Civilian Heroism.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Later on Sunday Morning, we'll meet some real heroes among us.
Our Sunday profile this morning features Viggo Mortensen, an actor of diverse talents and many different roles, as Tracy Smith will show us.
There is always hope.
Much like snowflakes, no two Viggo Mortensen performances are alike.
Now I'm going to do his teeth and cut off his fingers.
On purpose.
And my job is to look at the world from points of view other than my own, sometimes radically different.
His latest, a dad raising his kids in the wild. Off the Beaten Path with Viggo Mortensen, ahead on Sunday Morning.
'Tis the season for a drop-in from Techno Claws, the man in red, who some believe resembles our David Pogue.
It's 2 weeks before Christmas, and all through the land, the business of shopping for gifts is at hand. You want great ideas?
Want this one?
It's not a lost cause.
Good morning!
Coming up, this year's visit from old Techno Claws.
On Broadway is where actress Sutton Foster got her first big break many years ago, and she's still wowing them on stage, while also finding time to talk to our Mo Rocca.
So let me get right to the point.
Sutton Foster isn't just a two-time Tony Award-winning triple threat.
My friends could see me.
She's also a TV star.
You are way too young for me.
Yet she hasn't gone Hollywood.
You want to go poop? I think we might get a poop. Yay! This is what Broadway stars don't. You get out of there.
A real actress cleans up her dog's poop.
Later on Sunday Morning.
That was excellent.
The scoop on Sutton Foster.
Come on, guys.
Richard Schlesinger takes a walk with the very street-smart comedian Billy Eichner. Connor Knighton is on the trail to Hawaii's Volcanoes National Park. Bill Flanagan remembers a chance encounter with hero astronaut John Glenn. And more.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Everyday heroes actually aren't all that rare. Still, acts of heroism in the face of mortal danger are unusual enough that when they happen, there ought to be a medal. And as Scott Simon of NPR will now tell us, there is.
Here's a question for you.
It's Spider-Man!
Do heroes look like this? Or like this? Ashley Aldridge, a 19-year-old mother of two in Auburn, Illinois.
I was making lunch for the kids, and I had just finished cleaning up when I saw Earl sitting out here yelling for help.
She didn't know Earl Mormon's name then, just that he was a stranger in a wheelchair on the train tracks right outside her home.
I went to the neighbor and asked him if he could watch the kids for a minute while I came to check on Earl.
Earl is 75 years old. His wheelchair had gotten stuck on the train tracks, and he was stuck in his chair.
At first, I tried to lift the wheelchair up out of the tracks, but I realized that wasn't going to work. So I grabbed him from behind and tried to lift him up over the wheelchair.
He's a big guy.
Yeah.
The guard arms had closed because a train was roaring straight at them.
Every time I looked up, it was closer. And the point when I actually was able to get him out, I was pulling him back and the train smashed into the chair. It was seconds after I pulled him out. Are you in the slide?
Heroes like Ashley Aldridge are courageous and rare. But each year, something called the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission gives medals, scholarships, medical expenses if required, and a reward of about $5,000 to an average of 88 people in the United States and Canada.
Lots of people think they know what a hero is. You have a particular definition.
It's a person who's under no obligation to act, leaves a place of safety, puts himself or herself in serious risk of death or major injury to save the life of another human being.
Mark Lasko is chairman of the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission in Pittsburgh.
These people are almost always rescuing strangers. They're not bound to them by family or tribe or any personal interest.
The Carnegie Hero Fund is one of many philanthropic institutions founded by Andrew Carnegie. He came to Pittsburgh from Scotland when he was just a boy and rose to become one of the titans of the American steel industry and one of the richest men in the world. In 1901, at the age of 65, he sold the Carnegie Corporation and put his millions to work in foundations that still bear his name.
He was a man of ideas. He was tremendously concerned with issues of peace and justice and ethics and established organizations to support all of those things.
And then, on a frigid January day in 1904, a mine explosion near Pittsburgh killed 181 men. Andrew Carnegie was shaken, and he shared his sorrow in this letter pulled from the foundation's archive. "I can't get those widows and children of the mine out of my head," he wrote. He was particularly moved by the stories of two men, Selwyn Taylor and Daniel Lyle, who gave their lives trying to save men they had never met who were trapped in the mine. Carnegie minted two medals in their honor and gave them to their families, making Taylor and Lyle the first Carnegie heroes.
I really have to say that for our family in general, you know, heroism has always been pretty high.
Linda Thorell Hills is Andrew Carnegie's great-granddaughter. She sits on the board of the Hero Fund.
A tragedy or something terrible can be taking place, and a whole bunch of people are just standing there and going, "Oh, my God, what do we do?" Or they don't do anything, or they run the other way. And then this individual somehow finds that deeper inner strength that they're compelled to help this person in need.
In the last 112 years, over 9,800 men, women, and children have been honored. Each has a remarkable story. Lewis Bowman of Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, was one of the first to receive the award. He rescued a man from drowning on July 17, 1904. On March 26, 1912, 12-year-old Henry Matthews of Dothan, Alabama, saved a 3-year-old from an abandoned well. Professional boxer Rudell Stitch of Louisville, Kentucky, received the award twice. The first time in 1958, when he rescued a man working on a dam on the Ohio River. 2 years later, a second rescue attempt was unsuccessful. Both men died. 28-year-old Stitch received the award posthumously.
At that second, I'm taking my boots and my coat off, and I've decided I'm going in after.
You may remember Lenny Skutnik. January 13, 1982, he dove into the frozen waters of the Potomac River to save a plane crash victim as she began to drown. 78 people died that day. There were only 5 survivors, and thanks to Lenny Skutnik, one of them was Priscilla Tirado, who lost her husband and baby in the crash.
Then I swam off to the side, and that was mission accomplished.
None of them think they did anything extraordinary. They think that it just is something that you do, and yet we well know that that's not true.
I don't know why I ran towards it. I just, you know, I would hope that anybody would have done the same thing.
But would we? Andy Baugh is 29 years old, a husband, father, and a midget car racer. He was on the track last year when he saw a rival car crash and burst into a fireball. He stopped his own racer to run toward the one on fire and reached through the flames for the driver, a 14-year-old kid he'd never met named Chase McDermott.
I just reached down there and grabbed Chase, all 90 pounds of him, and underneath of his arms and pulled him out and kind of jumped on him.
Both Andy and Chase walked away from that fire unscathed.
You risk your life for another human being.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. You don't think any of that stuff at the time, you know. It didn't matter then.
And you worried for your own life?
I don't know. I wasn't. Not at the time. I sure wasn't. You
will be out. And so Eric Zarin, director of the Carnegie Hero Fund, presented Andy with his medal quietly in the McDermott family home, as this hero preferred.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm very honored to get it. It kind of helps sink it all in some. You know, nobody wants to be dubbed a hero, I guess. It was hard for me to accept. Everybody's calling me a hero, and to me, it was just right place, right time.
It defines us as human beings to take yourself from a place where you are safe to a place of grave danger to try to save another life is uniquely human. And I think it's a wonderful defining attribute of humanity. It makes us special, and it makes those who can do that even more special.
To date, almost 89,000 people have been nominated for the award. You would be awed to hear almost any of their stories, but only about 1 in 10 is chosen.
Why would someone not measure up?
A risk is the primary requirement, and many of the cases simply are just not risky enough.
Walter Rutkowski, who's now president of the fund, was one of its investigators for many years.
They are life-saving deeds, which is wonderful, but they don't have that element of extraordinary risk that the commission requires. It's the damsel tied to the railroad track, and the knight comes and unleashes her right before the train strikes.
And sometimes the knight is a damsel, which brings us back to Ashley Aldridge.
It is indeed my honor and privilege to present today the Carnegie Medal for Heroism to Ashley Marie Aldridge for her life-saving actions on September 15, 2015. Ashley, congratulations.
Thank you.
And the biggest reward isn't a medal or money.
I would want someone to do that for me if that was my grandpa stuck. So, I just had to.
Just what a hero would say.
Coming up, we say cheese. And now a page from our Sunday Morning Almanac. December 11th, 1874, 142 years ago today. The day James Lewis Craft was born on a small farm in the Canadian province of Ontario. As a young man, Craft went into the cheese business, ending up in Chicago, where he sold his wares from a wagon for a while. In 1914, Craft's company purchased its first cheese factory in Stockton, Illinois. His big breakthrough came 2 years later when he received a patent for his improved process of sterilizing cheese so that it would keep without spoiling. Kraft's processed cheese quickly became a huge success. The U.S. Army bought 6 million pounds of it during World War I. and millions of pounds more during World War II. In between came a product welcomed by families struggling to make ends meet during the Great Depression.
It was actually one of our sales reps who put together a grated cheese along with a macaroni.
A few years ago, Kraft Foods' Eileen Sharkey Rosenfeld told the mac and cheese tale to Sunday Morning.
The idea of having both things together in one package was just revolutionary.
And that brings us to another staple of the American diet, the grilled cheese sandwich. With processed cheese dominating one category of the 2013 Grilled Cheese Invitational, our Bill Geist spoke with founder Tim Walker.
There's the Love American style, which is just white bread, orange cheese and butter, no additional ingredients.
How do you stand out in that category?
Grilling acumen.
And though cheese purists may argue that processed cheese isn't real cheese, that's hardly hurt its popularity.
America spells cheese, it's K-R-A-F-T.
When it comes to simplicity, practicality, and a long shelf life, processed cheese stands alone. Hungry yet?
Don't touch. Miss Olivia.
Ahead.
How famous are you?
I'm on my way, in my mind.
Comic Billy Eichner, streetwise.
Don't touch. Doesn't deserve to touch you. He has an Emmy Award. Took him 7 times, but still he won.
Congratulations.
Go, for a dollar. Be honest. Who's hotter, Abraham Lincoln or Barack Obama?
Oh, Barack Obama.
Oh, sorry, it's Abraham Lincoln. It all goes by my opinion. By the way, you're...
Joking around with Michelle Obama is one way comic Billy Eichner burnishes his street smart credentials. Confronting regular folks on the street is another. Richard Schlesinger shows what we mean.
Who do you think's funnier? Be honest. Me or Seth Rogen?
Oh my God, you.
Thank you!
Oh my God, a million times.
Really?
I don't think he's funny at all.
Oh wow, well he's right here, Seth Rogen!
That voice, it's hard to miss. And it belongs to Billy Eichner, one of the new voices in comedy.
Miss Olivia Wilde is beautiful.
Please tell me I'm beautiful.
You're gorgeous.
Yes, yes, let's go, let's go. Look at her skin. Look at her skin and die trying to get it. Miss.
He is loud.
You're damn right I am.
And in your face.
I like the movie and I hope you do another one.
Thank you. And it did make an enormous amount of cash.
Oh, why don't you shove that down our faces? We know you're very rich.
Not me. I'm just
and so he's cool. Starting to be heard in Hollywood.
Miss for a dollar. Look who it is.
The God very is city the right he loves oh to mock.
Yes, what's his name?
Chris Evans.
No, Chris Pratt.
How famous are you?
I'm on my way in my mind. I think I've made a lot of progress. I don't know what level of fame that is, but I'm fine with it. I actually really enjoy whatever it is I have right now.
Oh my God, it's you.
Yes!
What he has ending. Is this show.
For a dollar, who would you rather meet, your mother or Neil Patrick Harris?
Patrick Harris.
He's right here!
I didn't see him.
Billy on the Street, right where 38-year-old Eichner races around New York.
What's his name?
With A-list celebrities like Will Ferrell in tow, along with many more.
Hey guys, I'm John Hamm, and I'm on Billy on the Street.
Yes!
Confronting unsuspecting pedestrians.
Don't touch her. She doesn't deserve to touch you.
With a high-octane, staccato talk show.
Drive!
Slash prank fest.
And down the stretch they come!
Slash very low-stakes game show.
Miss, for a dollar, would you have sex with Paul Rudd? That's Paul
Rudd. Of course I would.
Yes, thank you. Here's a dollar.
It started its 5th season now on True TV.
The Billy on the Street character, if you know me, is extremely separate from who I am.
People are like, he's loud, he's gay, I can tolerate him in small doses.
His character is pushy, to say the least.
Okay, FLOTUS, hold on, let me get in the cart.
But here he is being pushed around by First Lady Michelle Obama.
Stop!
He also co-stars on Difficult People, a sitcom about bitter showbiz wannabes. It was just renewed for a 3rd season on Hulu, the video streaming service.
Okay, what's today?
It's Tuesday.
No, Billy, it's Thursday.
What?
You've been sleeping for 3 days.
I slept for 3 days?
And until recently, until YouTube,
let's go!
He could never have gotten where he did.
Well, Tina Fey,
Yes, Billy.
You lost
how he thing. Did.
Ladies, it's Fashion Week.
Yeah! Yeah!
Eichner invented Billy on the Street when he was appearing way off Broadway in his own show.
I go into a store, I see the mannequin, and if it looks...
I'm bored.
It got a little notice, but when he put the show on YouTube, it got a lot of notice.
I could take these meetings in L.A. and say, hey, 500,000 people think this video is great. Look what they're saying about me on the blogs. Like, this is beyond a small... This will go beyond a small circle of people in Manhattan, and it did.
Eichner started performing in the smallest circle of all, as a child, in his parents' living room.
This is where I lived from like 2 years on. And this is my window right here. It's a very small apartment.
He was raised in Queens, New York, and Billy the Kid was one lousy neighbor.
I would sing late at night. People would complain. I remember the neighbors coming down and knocking on our door and saying to my mom, we wish him the best of luck, but it's just very late.
The songs were mostly numbers from the Broadway shows his parents took him to see.
How about a nice hand for my man Bill once again for doing such a tremendous job, ladies and gentlemen.
By the time he was bar mitzvahed, right. It was pretty clear where he was headed. He knew it.
We be diamond.
And his late mother knew it.
Have a long, happy, healthy life, and I do hope we'll see you in Hollywood.
I would put on a suit to watch the Oscars. I mean, no one's proud of it, Richard, but it's what happened.
There's nothing to be ashamed of.
I don't know why, but I had show business, the performing arts, in my blood from as far back as I can remember.
The thing is, he could have been a rocket scientist or any other kind of scientist. No joking.
So does this look the same?
It looks exactly the same. It's a beautiful school.
Yeah, it is. And are you up here?
That's me.
Oh.
He was accepted into a famed high school for performing arts. But instead, he decided to attend the uber selective Stuyvesant High School in New York, one of the top schools in the nation for math and science.
I was a good student. This is where you went. If you got into this school, you went.
Like Eichner himself, Billy on the Street is not just smart, it's quick.
For a dollar, what's the name of the theater David Letterman films his TV show in?
The Tonight Show.
No! No!
No!
No!
No!
That never happened!
No!
Matt Damon.
If Eichner and his act all seem ridiculous, it was all serious enough for The New Yorker. Yes, The New Yorker.
They wrote about me in The New Yorker. Not too shabby.
There was his profile, alongside essays about photographer Diane Arbus and British politician Jeremy Corbyn. Eichner was dubbed hyper-literate in the language of pop culture.
I love the incongruity of it. And we belong in The New Yorker, and we also belong, you know, on some pop culture blog.
Billy, do something crazy!
And if Billy Eichner is not a name in every household yet, that's okay. That's what he says. Of course, he could be kidding.
I'm very comfortable where I'm at, and as long as I keep working and doing good things, whatever fame comes along with that comes along, and if it doesn't, it doesn't.
I mean...
But it will, Richard.
Yes, yes, you'll see to it, won't you?
Still to come...
Yes, it's Technoclaws.
Start making a list. But first, a musical treasure in Tulsa.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's a heart rings gonna fall. That's Patti Smith singing Bob Dylan's A Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall at yesterday's Nobel Prize ceremony. He, of course, was absent. Physically absent, perhaps, but a presence in that hall nonetheless, as he has been in our lives for more than half a century.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are a-changing.
The words were true then, and they're true now. The 20-something Bob Dylan who first sang them, well, he's now 75. But age hasn't mellowed America's poet.
Bob Dylan.
Take winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. The Swedish Academy couldn't even find Dylan to tell him the news. When they did finally reach the singer-songwriter, he was pleased by the honor. It wasn't totally unexpected. Dylan doesn't talk much. He just sings. And while his story is well known, where the artifacts of that story are stored is one of the best-kept secrets around.
What we're looking at is just kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Welcome to the Bob Dylan Archive. Thousands of his personal writings and items housed at the University of Tulsa. Michael Chaikin is the curator.
You know, the biggest surprise in the archive, not just for me, but also for his biographers and people who have seriously studied his work, was the amount of writing that Bob managed to hold on to.
Why Oklahoma? For starters, it's the home state of Woody Guthrie, one of Dylan's biggest influences. And then there's the money. Dylan sold his collection to the school for an undisclosed amount, reportedly as much as $15 million. And it is a treasure trove. Among the items, the initial draft of one of the most famous songs of all time.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bump of dime in your prime. Then you...
These songs didn't arrive full-formed. I mean, Bob was a worker. I mean, whatever his native talents and his wit and his intelligence, I mean, he had an incredible writerly discipline.
And here are his notes, the lyrics that would eventually become Subterranean Homesick Blues.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
There are the musings that would become Maggie's Farm and Tangled Up in Blue.
I had a job in the Great North Woods, working as a cook for a spell. But I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell.
Along with manuscripts, musical instruments.
And this is the tambourine that inspired Bob's song, Mr. Tambourine Man.
Also, clothes. This is the leather jacket Dylan wore the night he went electric and was booed by fans who felt betrayed. There's his first publishing contract.
In 1962, Bob got $1,000 advance.
The goal is to make the archive available to researchers, scholars, and the public. But will the man himself pay a visit?
You would have to ask Bob Dylan. I don't know.
What we do know is what it means to the rest of us.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to.
Ahead, we're Broadway bound with Sutton Foster. That's Sutton Foster singing a Cole Porter classic. She's been a star on Broadway for a while now. And though she's branched out recently, she's never forgotten her first big break. Mo Rocca has her story.
You're going out a youngster, but you've got to come back a star.
It's a showbiz myth.
Oh, there she is now. Good luck.
As old as showbiz itself. The understudy who overnight becomes a star.
This is 1922.
But it actually happened to Sutton Foster. In the year 2000, Foster was the 25-year-old understudy to the lead in the Broadway-bound musical Thoroughly Modern Millie.
In my heart, he'll be a star.
When director Michael Mayer called her.
He said that the woman playing Millie has left the show and the role of Millie is yours if you want it. I was on the other line with the boyfriend at the time, and I was like, what? And like, clicked off with Michael Mayer, went back to the boyfriend. I was like, I have to call you back.
But the fact is, everything today is thoroughly modern.
It was just 1 week before opening night.
You've made a mistake. I mean, I think I said that. I was like crying. I was like, why are you making a mistake? Like, why would you take a risk on this, on me?
But it was a risk that paid off. Foster went out there an unknown and came back with her first Tony Award.
Sutton Foster!
One of the things that I'm most proud of is that the opportunity came and I was ready, meaning I was prepared, I knew my stuff, I worked really hard, and I stepped in.
Yes, for now we'll go on living.
Sutton Foster was born in Georgia and started dancing when she was 4 years old. Her father worked for General Motors. Her mother, whose dream of becoming a model never worked out, gently nudged Sutton and her older brother Hunter onto the stage. When Mrs. Foster saw that a local theater company was producing Annie, she knew who should play the title role.
My mother said, you should audition. And I was like, I don't want to. I want to play with my friend Bethany. And she was over. And my mom was like, you should go. And Bethany can come too. And we went to the audition. I had to sing. And my mom said the room got really quiet. And then they cast me as Annie.
Would you say that your mother was a stage mother?
I wouldn't say my mom was a stage mom. Because she wasn't like Mama Rose. It wasn't like that. But I will say that she was the one who's encouraged us to go to the library and take out musicals so we could listen, because we didn't know what Broadway was. I was like, what's Les Mis? What's Phantom? She wasn't like aggressive. Stage mom has such a negative connotation to it, but she was definitely responsible.
Welcome 15-year-old Sutton Foster.
And it was Foster's mother who saw the ad to audition for the TV show that Sutton was obsessed with.
You're my world, you're every prayer I pray.
Challenger Sutton Foster receives 3.5 stars.
I lost.
You came in second.
I get out of two people.
And it's that kind of gumption that's endeared Foster to audiences in show-stopping role after role after role. She won her second Tony in Cole Porter's Anything Goes.
Anything goes.
When you were Reno Sweeney in Anything Goes, there was that impossible to believe 8-minute tap dance break.
I kept thinking it would get easier, and it never did. Every night I thought my face was gonna explode, but it never did, which was good.
Foster can sing, and she can dance. But what sets her apart is her acting.
A lot of people say, what's most important, acting, singing, or dancing? And I say, always acting, because singing without acting is just noise.
Because it's got to be fast, too.
Dancing without acting is just arm movement. I don't feel like I'm just moving around and doing, like, fancy footwork.
That's it.
Same thing can go with singing. Someone can sing super high notes.
Tonight I've landed, pal.
But if it's not based in any reality or any purpose, then it's just showboating.
If my friends could see me now.
And it's the acting that definitely plays lead in her current role as Charity Hope Valentine.
The minute you walked in the joint.
The dance hall hostess searching for love in the new group's off-Broadway production of Sweet Charity. The part was made famous on stage by Gwen Verdon and in the movie by Shirley MacLaine. Foster's Charity is surprisingly funny.
Give me your hand.
And no less poignant.
What is Charity doing wrong that she has this string of relationships and she can't quite seem to get it right?
Charity is desperate to be saved.
There's gotta be something better than
she wants to be saved from this life that she's in. She thinks maybe a man will save her. It doesn't matter who the guy is. If it's a guy, he's the one.
I'm gonna get up, I'm gonna get out, I'm gonna get up, get out and do it.
Charity is a woman struggling to figure out what will make her happy. Foster faced a similar quandary after her divorce from actor Christian Borle in 2009.
I kept equating it to like someone took my purse and dumped it out on the sidewalk. And it was all my stuff, like everywhere. And for 3 years, I was like sludging through mud to sort of rebuild myself.
It's a very evocative image, like dump your purse out. It sounds like something that would happen to Charity.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. Charity and I go way back. What's interesting is that I know her because I think I have been her, but luckily I don't feel like I'm her now.
Foster is now married to screenwriter Ted Griffin.
Since you're always compared to Mary Tyler Moore, are you ever tempted to throw your hat up in the air?
They live in New York, where she stars in the TV comedy Younger.
You are way too young for me.
I'm 26, dude. I mean, we gotta be the same age, give or take.
She plays a 40-something single mom passing herself off as a 26-year-old to get work.
Donald Trump wants to wear the crown. Tell him no.
Okay.
Amy Schumer wants to wear the crown. Tell her yes.
On it.
But for Sutton Foster, this isn't so big a stretch.
Yeah.
A word that was used to describe you a lot early on was plucky. Just
plucky.
A lot, right.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that word?
Plucky. I mean, it's pretty right on, especially in my youth. I mean, in my youth. Like, I've been like 15 my entire life. You know, my tagline on my phone says, sent from the land of puppy dogs and rainbows. Like, I'm like a little Pollyanna. I look right at the world with rose-colored glasses. I'm incredibly hopeful. In many ways, still very naive. I think a lot of that has helped me, meaning my sort of naivete has sort of gotten me in trouble at times, but it's also like I haven't stopped myself from doing things.
So you get to live in New York City, where you work on the stage just a couple miles away and do a TV show in town. You're living the dream.
It's pretty cool.
Next.
It notes your car's position when you park.
Here comes Technoclaws.
'Tis the season for gifts, a challenge that cries out for Technoclaws, who some people think bears a striking resemblance to David Pogue of Yahoo Tech.
Good morning. Yes, it's Technoclaws, your gift-suggesting friend, appearing one night only for your pleasure at year's end. And let's be glad the year is over, if I may be frank. With Zika, Brexit, violence, that election, this year stank. Let's turn our minds to brighter things, like what I brought this year. Some high-tech gifts all guaranteed to spread a little cheer. If you, like me, are longing for less awful times gone by, the classic NES Nintendo might just catch your eye. It plugs into your TV here, and presto, you're in biz with 30 games from days of yore. Your teenage years, that is. A picture frame that's digital? It's not a new idea, but get your folks a nice one, like these Knicks plays I got here. You send them shots remotely from your laptop or your phone, and they'll show up in Shanghai while you're back here in Bayonne. The metal frame looks great and has a motion sensor here. The screen goes dark when it decides that nobody is near. The Zeus is for your car. You see, you plug it in as shown. It charges two devices, like your tablet and your phone. And when the night has fallen, look, it lights up in the dark. But best of all, it notes your car's position when you park. An app directs you back to it, like radar scans of old. It's $30 in plastic, or $500 in gold. Alarm clocks wake you up with noise, like hammers in your head. But this one wakes you up with smells, like mint or toasted bread. It's called the Sensor Wake, a handy moniker because when morning comes, a lovely scent comes wafting up your schnoz. And if 3 minutes pass and you're still lying there out cold, some music plays as backup, like alarmin' clocks of old. It seems as though all things in life go digital one day, and now it seems a notebook has seen fit to go that way. The Wave, it's called. You use it with this special kind of pen. You make your brilliant sketches as you always have, and then an app, a snap, and presto! All your notes are now online. It's in your email, Google Docs, what have you. See? Here's mine. And when it's full, you just erase it. Use again. See, look. You pop it in the microwave and simply cook the book. It's all just stuff. I'll grant you that. But hey, be of good cheer. I'll also try to bring you all a happier next year.
Next.
It's amazing how much history and knowledge is encased in each one of these individuals.
Thank you so much for your time.
Living history.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
With the ranks of American veterans of World War II dwindling every day, Steve Hartman has found a young man who means to keep their stories of heroism alive.
For as long as he can remember, 19-year-old Rishi Sharma has been fascinated with World War II. But it wasn't until recently that he realized this history is still living.
There are real superhero World War II vets out there, and I want to meet them.
So in 2014, as a junior in high school, Rishi made it his mission.
I ditched so many days of high school to go do an interview.
You were skipping school to go interview vets?
Yeah. I started riding my bike to the local senior home. I interviewed those guys. Then I started driving.
Today, he tries to meet one a day.
Every single day.
Drives all over Southern California searching out every World War II combat vet he can find.
I had a lot of missions.
Like Marine Tank Commander Ernie Isley.
They were going to make a big camp there and attack us at night.
Rishi talks to these guys for hours.
Wow.
Then gives the recordings to the families. Thank you so much. So far, he has interviewed more than 210 combat vets. A remarkable total, but a monumental failure as far as he's concerned. Rishi says we're losing about 400 World War II vets a day. He can't talk to them fast enough.
It's amazing how much history and knowledge is encased in each one of these individuals and how much is lost when one of them dies without sharing their story. The fact is, I wake up every day to obituaries, guys who I wanted to interview, and I have to find out that, you know, they died.
At this point, I should tell you, Rishi doesn't come from a military family. His parents immigrated here from India. And yet, he cares more about our greatest generation than any teenager I have ever met.
My name is Rishi Sharma.
In addition to his daily interview, he calls at least five World War II vets a day just to thank them for their service and sacrifice.
It means a great deal to me that you were willing to endure all of that so that I could be here today.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanking veterans and preserving their legacies is so important to Rishi. He's now delaying college, starting a GoFundMe, and expanding his mission across the country.
This is a map of all the places that I'm planning to go to.
This is a multi-year trip, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to be on the road for years. Yeah, well, I thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Nice to know. As long as there are World War II veterans willing to talk, there will be at least one young man willing to listen.
I mean it. You mean a lot to me.
I swore to protect you. Can you protect me from yourself?
Still to come, Viggo Mortensen. And later...
It's so impressive.
We go with the flow.
Now you must die.
I summon you to fulfill your oath.
None but the King of Gondor may command me.
It's Sunday morning on CBS, and here again is Jane Pauley. The Lord of the Rings movie trilogy made Viggo Mortensen a very big star. Added proof for anyone who needs it that he can command just about any kind of role. Tracy Smith has our Sunday profile.
I can avoid being seen if I wish, but to disappear entirely, that is a rare gift.
Who are you? Where are you taking us?
Into the wild.
Watching his bold heroics in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, it's clear the camera loves Viggo Mortensen.
There is always hope.
But the soft-spoken actor isn't so sure whether the feeling's mutual.
The camera's your friend, but it's like this person that's there that doesn't talk. But they have really good eyesight, and
it's very true.
So you should be on your toes. It's this mute, hawk-eyed friend that doesn't know how to keep a secret. I'm not afraid of you.
Let us together rebuild this world, that we may share in the days of peace.
Making friends with the camera has turned Mortensen into a respected movie star, with roles ranging from blockbuster king...
Now I'm going to do his teeth and cut off his fingers.
...to art house villain.
He is
with some sparks along the way.
He has kissed her.
But his most recent movie, Captain Fantastic, finds Mortensen, who has a 28-year-old son, playing a part he says he's more comfortable with these days, a dad.
What Ben and I have created here may be unique in all of human existence. We created a paradise out of Plato's Republic.
I play a father of six children, and we live off the grid. We live in the middle of the forest in the northwest of the United States.
Why does Mommy have to be gone so long?
Something tragic happens, which makes them have to leave the forest.
Attention all campers, this is your captain speaking. Here we have the embodiment of Calvin Coolidge's statement that the business of America is business.
When they leave the forest and meet other kids, other families, see towns, see cities, they're socially inept, which is understandable.
What's wrong with everyone?
Are they sick?
What do you mean?
Everyone's so fat.
Yeah, they are.
Fat like hippos.
That's not nice to say.
But look!
The movie got good reviews, and there's lots of awards buzz for Viggo. But in typical dad fashion, he wants to share all the credit with his young castmates.
You'll fall in love with these six kids.
Oh my goodness, yes.
I mean, they're beautiful.
Mortensen's own childhood was an international one. Born in Manhattan, his mother was American, his father Danish, he spent his first decade of life in South America, Argentina mostly. When his parents divorced, he moved with his mom to upstate New York.
When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A crow was probably what I wanted to be, most of all.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that? What is it about crows?
They're survivors. They can live anywhere, very self-sufficient, they're very resourceful. Adaptable.
That sounds like you.
Yeah.
Do you think you could live off the grid?
Yeah. I mean, I have.
Today, the divorced actor splits his time between Spain, where his girlfriend lives, and wherever work is, always making sure he can get outdoors, often alone.
Some people, if they're not on the phone or hearing the radio or interacting with somebody, you know, every half hour or so, then they start to get nervous. It's like, where is everybody, you know? It's like, I'm glad nobody's here, personally, except you and
all
me.
All right, yeah, you and me. Thanks for adding that, Viggo. On that note. He took an acting class on a whim in his early 20s, never expecting it'd become a career. But a small part in Witness, the Oscar-winning 1985 film starring Harrison Ford, got Viggo noticed.
Look what I got! I mean, look at me! You got everything!
And
man.
From there, the jobs just kept coming.
A bird will fall frozen dead from a bough without ever having felt sorry for itself.
You have some skill with a blade.
But this is the role he nearly turned down. Cast at the last minute, Mortensen was unsure he could do the part.
I swore to protect you.
Can you protect me from yourself?
But his son Henry, who was 11 at the time, told him to grasp the ring.
He said, Dad, you should do that. You know, and I was explaining, well, it'll take a long time. I'm not really ready. He says, you'll figure it out. You know, you should do it. It's really, could be good.
And your son convinced you?
He was right.
And what was his review?
Fortunately, it was good. He liked it.
And so did just about everyone else. The film trilogy is one of the most successful franchises of all time and turned Mortensen into an international movie star.
I mostly look at it as a positive thing, this attention that we all got from the extraordinary success of Lord of the Rings, because it gave me opportunities. It gave me more options, more stories to pick from.
This is headquarters?
Yep, this is Percival Press. This is
and a chance to tell a few stories of his own.
These are our newer books are out here. Do music too, he's a bunch of CDs.
With money he made from Lord of the Rings, Mortensen was able to start his own publishing company, Percival Press.
A great poet named Scott Wahnberg.
Where he can help out lesser-known stars in other fields.
This is a typical book of ours, something that might not have been published otherwise, and certainly not in this way.
It's also an outlet for Mortensen's other talents, poetry and painting, photography and music.
You're in very wrong place, Anna Ivanovna. You belong in there, with nice people.
And he's found poetic moments in his acting career, too. When his role in 2007's Eastern Promises got him a slew of Best Actor nominations, he brought his movie-loving mom as his date.
The best experience that season where I was nominated for that movie was the SAG Awards. You know, anybody I knew would come over, is this your mom? And I said, yep. She would say, that's so-and-so. He directed this and that and that. And she was like, that's not. And that's John Travolta. And she goes, hang on a second. She got up and walked over and she says, hello. And then she's pointing over to me and said, that's my son. And I was like, wow. It was great. It was great. She's gone now. But we did do that. And I'm really, really, that was a special, very memorable experience.
It's precious.
Yeah.
Our children shall be philosopher kings. Makes me so indescribably happy.
Now, with Captain Fantastic, there's talk he'll be nominated for some big awards once again. But whatever happens next, Viggo Mortensen says he's already won.
As far as acting, I mean, if Captain Fantastic was my last role, I've had a good run. That wouldn't be too bad a way to go out, you know, but you never know.
Earlier, we met some everyday heroes who risked mortal danger in order to save others. Now, our Bill Flanagan remembers the time he met an American hero of the sort you really don't meet every day. Former astronaut and Senator John Glenn, who died this past week at age 95.
I met John Glenn at a reception at the White House in May of 2012. A woman came up to me and said she and her parents were fans of Sunday Morning. Would I mind saying hello to them? I said, sure. What are your folks' names? She said, John and Annie Glenn. I almost fell over. I've met a lot of famous people, but John Glenn was in a different league.
I don't know any words for this except the trite ones. Tension is mounting.
My first grade teacher rolled a big black and white TV into our classroom. So we could all witness the launch of his 1962 orbit around the Earth. And pray for his safe return.
Oh, that view is tremendous.
I tried to think of something to say to him that wasn't a cliche. I told myself, don't bring up the Earth orbit, don't bring up the presidential run, the return to space when he was a 77-year-old senator. So as we were introduced, I just pulled something out of the air. I said, Senator Glenn, did you ever meet Lindbergh? And John Glenn's answer amazed me. Charles Lindbergh? I did some test piloting for him when he was an aviation executive, but I didn't get to know him until we flew together in the Pacific in World War II. Now I was stunned. Charles Lindbergh, you probably know this, went from being the world's most beloved man after crossing the Atlantic in 1927 to being hated during World War II. Lindbergh had campaigned to keep the United States out of the war.
I do not believe that our American ideals and our way of life will gain through an unsuccessful war.
And by the time of Pearl Harbor, he was denounced as a Nazi sympathizer. He tried to get into combat to redeem his name, but no branch of the service would have him. Finally, Lindbergh was so desperate to get into the fight that he flew himself to the middle of the Pacific War and volunteered as a civilian advisor. He went into aerial combat 50 times. He devised a way to deliver payloads of bombs to the Japanese mainland and get the planes back to base without running out of fuel. And all of this was done in secret. But nowhere in any book on either man that I can find is there any mention that one of the hotshot fighter pilots sent up to guard Lindbergh's flank was a young ace named John Glenn. The most famous aviator of the 1920s and the most famous astronaut of the 1960s flew into combat together in the 1940s, when Lindbergh's glory was years behind him and Glenn's was years in the future. Not long after that meeting at the White House, I visited the National Air and Space Museum. In the same room are two great physical icons, Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis and John Glenn's Mercury space capsule. Most fame is fleeting. Only a few men grow larger with the passage of time. Heroes are always exceptions. There was only one John Glenn.
Ahead.
There's a magma chamber that is coming up from the hot spot, feeding the molten magma.
On the trail in Hawaii.
Connor Knighton's tour through our national parks has taken him to Hawaii, where the heat is on.
At close to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, molten lava can be deadly. But its orange glow is also a reminder of just how alive our planet is. Here on the Big Island of Hawaii, the youngest island in our youngest state, new land is being formed every minute as magma from far beneath the Earth's surface bubbles up to crackle and cool.
It's so impressive to see the lava. It's like nothing else. It makes you understand we live on this giant burning cinder. But we never think that. Living in New York, when you walk around New York, you don't think there's lava like way, way below me.
Right.
You know, but here you remember that.
When Robert Trickey looks out his windows, he gets a daily reminder of how lava built this island.
And my property only goes out a little way, the rest is state land.
He built his home here in 2000, a modern structure of glass and concrete that was designed across the Pacific by San Francisco architect Craig Steele. It was the first in what has become a series for Steele, his lava flow homes. While some would see this jagged, rocky landscape as a challenge, Steele saw it as an opportunity.
The land is some of the newest land in the country. Is that exciting to have a chance to build on that?
Yeah, it is exciting that way. I mean, it feels like a responsibility to do something right on it.
Steele and his family spend part of the year in Lava Flow 2.
This is all like natural. This is all just kind of grown in.
A small 1,400 square foot home Steele designed for himself after falling in love with this area.
What I enjoy most about architecture is building buildings that really complement and amplify and really connect with where they're located.
In real estate, it's all about location. And when your location is near an active erupting volcano, well, the land comes cheaply for a reason.
So Kilauea Volcano, Mauna Loa Volcano, are over a geologic hotspot. There's a magma chamber that is coming up from the hotspot, feeding the molten magma.
Jessica Farrakane is a ranger at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. That's volcanoes, plural. Mauna Loa, the largest volcano on Earth, last erupted here in 1984. Kilauea has been continuously erupting since 1983.
We like to joke that we're the only national park that gets our land for free. And, you know, Kilauea has created more than 550 acres of new land since 1983 when Pu'u'o'o started to erupt again out in the East Rift Zone.
The East Rift Zone isn't far from Tricky's neighborhood. Lava was last here in 1955. It will almost certainly be here again.
Do you think about what could happen in the future?
Sure, and that's an interesting question that people ask a lot. How can you live here knowing that it could come? You just make your peace with it. You just simply know that it's part of life. I think in some ways it makes you remember life is passing. You know, it's not permanent. You're not like permanently here.
For Steele, that's part of the allure. It's modern architecture for the present moment.
I think the fact that it is transient and the fact that it could be gone tomorrow, it makes you really aware of your time here, and in a way makes you appreciate it more.
For those who live along the lava, it's a mindset, an appreciation for the land, and an ability to go with the flow.
Before we take our leave this morning, some miscellaneous business.
And we begin at the Mall of America outside Minneapolis, which welcomed its first Black Santa Claus last weekend. He's Larry Jefferson, whom we first met last summer when Luke Burbank took us to a Santa convention in Branson, Missouri.
We wish you a Merry Christmas.
Sadly enough, Larry's debut at the mall provoked a few racist slurs on social media. But those comments are far outweighed by expressions of support. And why does he play Santa? Let him tell you.
I do it because I love it. I love being Santa, and I love bringing smiles and joy and happiness to people.
Now, what Doyle Owens brought to people over the years was unclaimed airline baggage. Lots and lots of it. His unclaimed baggage center, which he started in 1970, buys abandoned luggage sight unseen from airlines and sells it to shoppers. About $1 million a year, who hope to find treasure inside.
Did you say you got your watch here?
I did. I have my Cartier wristwatch.
Doyle Owens' son Brian explained the idea to our Bill Geist when he visited the huge Scottsboro, Alabama warehouse back in 2005.
It's a little bit like Christmas every day.
You have no idea what's in them.
We have don't have a clue what's in them.
Brian Owens' father Doyle died 8 days ago at age 85. But the unclaimed baggage center he founded lives on.
It is 9 o'clock and our store is now open.
And finally this. A letter from Minnesota's Lita Schaefer saying, in her words, "How about equal time for cats? Please do your research and give us an honest and genuine story about cat lovers," who she says outnumber dog lovers in this country.
We're not sure about that, but without a doubt, we're overdue for a cat story, which we will do, Ms. Schaefer. Promise. I'm Jane Pauley. Please join us here again next Sunday morning.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.